You are a market leader operating in a highly competitive industry where efficiency and tangible results are paramount. You have a small and dedicated marketing team focused on executing regular marketing communications that must deliver immediate, measurable outcomes. You need a marketing partner that can seamlessly collaborate with your team, ensuring swift and frictionless execution, all while achieving quantifiable results in real time. My name is Tyler Chisholm, and as the co-founder and CEO of Clear Motive Marketing, we can help. With over 15 years of working with clients exactly like you from across North America, we have the team, the skills, and the processes to deliver the marketing that matters to you. Reach out to me on LinkedIn or check out clearmotive.ca to learn more. Hello to Warm Collisions YYC. Welcome to my guest this morning, Mr. Zach Magnet. How are you doing, Zach?
Great, Tyler. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Yet again, another opportunity for me to learn. As my audience knows, selfishly, I love it. That's part of why I do this. Second part is I love to share stories about things that are going on in our province, in our city, in our part of the world that don't always get out there. Sometimes because those companies do a lot of work in other parts of the world, which we'll get into a little bit with you guys. You're the co-founder and chief financial officer at Solfium. So I always start by pleading ignorance. What is the Solfium? What do you guys do? What problem do you solve in the world? And let's launch off from there.
Sure. Let me get into it. I mean, we are in the distributed PV solar generation space. So anything that's rooftop solar, so non-utility scale projects, so for self-consumption. And we do applications for homes, small businesses, and corporate facilities, offices, production facilities, etc. Anything that's behind the meter, if you will, that's distributed generation.
Okay.
And what we're basically doing, I mean, there's some big, huge driving forces that apply globally that are driving this business. So first of all, the unit economics of the consumer. So solar is now the cheapest form of electricity in 75% of the world. Certainly applies in Mexico, where our launch market. So the electricity consumer saves money by making the switch. So that's a huge driving force that's sort of acting in parallel to any environmental decarbonization efforts. But absolutely, the unit economics are a massive factor that are going to drive this transition.
What you said about, you know, yes, there's a lot of factors, but often until it actually makes financial sense at scale, things are slow to change, like, just to be blunt.
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. And I mean, we've all read about the cost of solar decreasing. The tipping point, if you will, where the unit economics on their own, independent of government subsidies, independent of incentives, it's a relatively recent phenomenon. Yeah, I mean, call it the last, say, 5 years.
Okay.
COVID was in there, kind of disrupted things. But this is a relatively new phenomenon. I think we're at the dawn. I say that we're at the dawn of a once-in-a-generation infrastructure transition. But we are there. The unit economics aren't the same everywhere in the world. I mean, certainly in Mexico, because of the radiation patterns, the same length of days and nights, winter and summer, lots of sunny days, obviously close to the equator. Electricity grid rates factor in, so they pay higher grid rates than we do here, as an example. In Alberta, we've got natural gas, which has historically been at relatively low cost. Down east, they have hydro. So the cost of electricity through existing networks is also relevant to the economics of the consumer.
Of course.
But nevertheless, this is improving globally. We certainly see in Mexico, our customers can save up to 90% of their electricity costs over the life of their system.
I want to camp out on unit economics, which I think you're doing a little bit. Timing, time, distance, length, height. What does that look like when you say over the lifespan of the space? So unit economics over a 15-year lifespan, like trying to unpack that term because it's easy to skip over it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So it's we talk about a 25-year life for your typical system. So when I talk about the life of a system, I talk about a 25-year life. Of course, the panels can continue to produce beyond that. The efficiency kind of decreases. But that's what I refer to as over the life of the asset.
Okay.
Now, another sort of metric that we talk about is the sort of the payback period. In say Canada, Alberta, we're looking at, 5 to 10, and I mean, it has come down. But where we're operating, we're looking at 3 to 5 years, as low as 2 years for industrial projects. Once you factor in the impact of accelerated depreciation and the value of the carbon offsets relating to carbon tax. So that's one huge, huge driving force. If you'll allow me, I'll talk about the other driving force before I
please,
get to,
please.
To sort of what
yeah,
we're doing.
I have, Zach, I have so many questions. I'm guilty yeah. all the time, but please, please, let's paint the whole story and then we'll circle back. Absolutely.
For sure. For sure. So the other big, big, driving force is, multinational, commitments to net zero. So decarbonization of value chains. And this is something now, net zero mandates are becoming the norm globally. So any company that is involved in a multinational value chain is subject to some version of a net zero mandate of some sort with some type of roadmap. And achieving this is complex, right? And here we get to the two problems that we're solving. So for an individual electricity consumer, it's still too hard to make the transition with low friction, right? Okay. It's not, we're not putting a man on the moon. This is not rocket science, but the technology, the components, trying to find a reliable local installer, there's still a number of friction points obtaining financing for a customer. There's still a number of friction points that make it difficult for your typical electricity consumer to adopt solar. So that's problem number one. The second is for these corporate net zero mandates. This is an increasingly important mandate for corporates, but it's still non-core, and it's a hairy problem because specifically with their scope 3 emissions, just a little bit of background, scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions. Scope 1 is the emissions associated with an industrial process. So, I mean, cement is a good example. Just the process of manufacturing cement is energy intensive. So there's emissions associated with that. Scope 2 emissions are the emissions associated with energy use. So the electricity that you consume, if that electricity is generated by fossil fuels, there are emissions associated with that. Right. Scope 3 are the emissions of your supply chain. So, and it just depends, it varies on industry, but it includes suppliers, customers. So upstream, downstream value chains. So
One sounds like the prickliest of them all.
That is the prickly one. That is the 100%. One that is highly fragmented. So you've got
so many variables and so many factors.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got a big multinational. I mean, and we've done work with in you know, with many multinationals. And when we talk about going to market, you know, we'll revisit this. But Volkswagen, mm-hmm. you know, international automaker has adopted a mandate to decarbonize its entire value chain. So this includes downstream, right? They're going to be producing EVs so that their customers don't emit emissions, CO2. Their own industrial processes, of mm-hmm. course, are going to be, and that they have control over. What they have less direct control over is their suppliers. So auto parts manufacturers that feed into Volkswagen value chain, the way that they're doing it is they're telling their suppliers, if you want to be a supplier to Volkswagen, you must decarbonize your own operations. So what this is doing is it's creating both it's creating both investment globally, right? There is this global effort to decarbonize our entire, you know, our entire economies. Mm-hmm. So this is driving capital into the space. And at a very local level, it's also driving demand because there are no necessarily local auto parts manufacturers, but we have customers in Mexico who are auto parts manufacturers mm-hmm. who supply these multinational companies who are now being mandated to decarbonize their operations. Mm-hmm. So it's driving demand, it's driving investment, but it's still complex, right? So to the electricity consumer, it's too hard to buy solar. And for the corporates, it's a hairy, fragmented ecosystem, and they need help with that. And that's what we do. So Solfium, what we've done is we've created an ecosystem to eliminate friction for buyers and sellers. So you can think of it as a highly managed or curated marketplace.
Okay.
So I say marketplace, but it's not an open marketplace. So we offer a fit for purpose installed solution to our customers. So they're not picking, you know, between brand A, B, and C of panels or of inverters. You know, many customers won't know what an inverter is. It's the brains of the system, essentially. They don't have to interview local installers to decide who's the best. We provide, we curate the offering, and we provide a fit for purpose installed solution to the customer. Behind the scenes, we coordinate the activities between supply and demand. So, and to analogize to business models that might be known to your audience, we often say that we are providing an Uber-like solution for solar. So we are making it as easy for the electricity customer to adopt solar as it is for you and I to get a ride
call
on
Uber.
So that's the customer facing solution. Behind the scenes, it's a logistics optimization play. So we partner directly with the component manufacturers. We engage the local installers. We integrate the finance providers into the ecosystem. So we talk about it as the Amazon efficiency of a supply chain, right? So we are enabling, we are disintermediating the supply chain in the business. So we are allowing direct manufacturer to consumer purchasing. We partner with logistics providers to assemble a kit. So we say, you know, we leverage technology, obviously, to configure the requirements of a specific installation. You're going to need 10 panels. You're going to need an inverter, a mounting system, cabling. Our logistics providers put that in a box, deliver it to the customer. Then our trained and certified local installer will come and install that system. So it's a seamless process for the customer with the supply chain optimization, which obviously feed into the viability of the business model.
How many different markets, just thinking about that supply chain and the reality of supply chain in Canada versus US versus Mexico, just thinking about that. And we'll kind of talk about the different consumer segments being like the individual, the you and me in the story versus the you and me who are running a multinational. Talk to me first just about the realities of like, because you went to Mexico. I know some people have done business in Mexico. It's different than doing business in Canada. Let's just say that. Not good or bad, just different. How has that been setting up from a business perspective, making that same promise work across multiple jurisdictions from a supply chain perspective?
Sure. I mean, I'll talk about sort of two things. I'll get to the supply chain in a moment, but you know, doing business in Mexico, it comes from the characteristics of the founders of the business, I think, is a large part of the reason why we're in Mexico. And when we select the markets, the first market that we're in being Mexico, and the markets that we're going to pursue subsequently, it's effectively a Venn diagram. So on one side is the market characteristics of that specific market. So Mexico is a huge market, 120 million people, 83 million homes, you know, huge market, and one regulatory framework. So okay. It certainly has its challenges, but it's a nationally regulated ecosystem. Okay. So, you know, I talked about the radiation pattern, the relatively high electricity rates. A grid-generated electricity is still 80% fossil fuel generated in Mexico. So there's an environmental component. So the market characteristics of that market are very favorable for the business that we're building. And the other side of that Venn diagram is the experience of the founders. I'm an Alberta boy from Edmonton originally, chartered accountant by training. I've worked for most of my career in the international upstream oil and gas business. So I've worked in the Middle East, Africa. I've spent some time in Europe. So I've worked internationally, growing businesses. So my role was to work across borders in many diverse, challenging jurisdictions, if you will.
Yep.
Recruiting teams, setting up systems, processes to build organizations. So that's what I bring to the mix is experience in growing international businesses. I'm still here. I'm not in Mexico. Both of my co-founders have deep ties to Mexico. I'll start with Andres Friedman. He's a Uruguayan, Canadian, Hungarian citizen, born and raised in Uruguay. Went to school at McGill. and spent most of his career with Bombardier from Quebec. And he's had an international career in his own respects, international supply chains, which is relevant to our business model, program developments. He's been in operations and relevant to Solfium. He spent 5 years in Mexico, in Querétaro, which is the city where we're based, setting up a wing assembly plant for Bombardier. And that, in fact, so he's got some experience in Mexico, some ties both commercially and politically. And that is where he came across Juan Osuna, which is our third co-founder, Spanish citizen, engineer by training. Juan and Andres met when they were in aerospace. Juan relocated to Mexico to be part of the Bombardier ecosystem and has since transitioned to the solar business. Where he has worked for the Pretel Group.
It all makes sense when you lay the story out. It does. It does.
It's all coming together. So, so there's a German diversified OEM, and one of the components that they manufacture are inverters. So inverters are one of the key components to the solar system. Juan has been in the business trying to activate it, living the points of friction from the manufacturer's perspective. Mm-hmm. Components have become increasingly commoditized. So he's and that's where the genesis for Solfium came, and that's why we're starting out in Mexico.
That makes a ton of, and it's so relevant because you hear this, you're like, how did it happen? And oftentimes it is a situation. How long? I'm just looking on LinkedIn. 3 years, 3 months. Is that accurate in terms of the age of Solfium?
Yeah, that is. We started pandemic era company in my dining room, which is no longer a dining room. But we started off in December 2020, and we've been going strong since. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, circling back a little bit, thank you for that. It has all become clear. The consumer market versus the corporate market, specific about being in Mexico, how does that differ? Like, what is it like? Maybe let's just start with what's the weighting right now in terms of your clients, your customers. I know it's hard because a big corporate job probably outweighs size and space of like multiple, but is there a percentage or how's the business evolving so far in terms of split?
Sure. So, you know, definitely, you know, I mentioned sort of the two elements of the problem, right, from the electricity consumer and from the corporate. So most of our traction and our go-to-market strategy is very much to collaborate with corporates who are, you know, they've got the same two motivations. One, they can save money by going to solar because they just save money, right? And then everything around decarbonization, around many companies have corporate sustainability officers, so they're looking for solutions. They're looking for ways to achieve these goals of decarbonizing their operations, but doing it in a smart way, in an efficient way. And our ability to efficiently reach, measure, reduce, and then importantly, aggregate and report the impact, the decarbonization impact of this fragmented value chain is what is valuable to our corporate customers. So in order for us to offer a compelling offering to our corporate partners, it is important that we are able to reach up and down their value chain. And that's really the differentiator between us and a typical industrial installer of solar. So, okay. You know, we've got a number of examples where we're working with corporates, and there's all kinds of flavors to the collaborations. But
I like that. Lots of flavor. I like the flavors comment.
Sure, yes. Because, you know, there is the scope 1, 2, and 3 elements of decarbonization. So we've got some corporate customers that are focused on scope 2. They're saying, listen, we love the story. We have, you know, and this is, we're not talking about a 1 year plan or a 2 year plan, right? I mean, we're talking about a 10 year, 15, 20 year plan. Yeah. So, and a lot of companies are saying, listen, we want to eventually get to the point where we can, you know, we can work with you to reach our supply chain. And, you know, there's a number of different ways where you can provide value, to customers. I can give you a couple of examples, but they say, you know, first of all, we want to lead by example.
Let's clean up our own house.
So, you know, an example, we're working with Pepsi in Mexico, and they've got, you know, obviously they've got all, you know, facilities, production facilities throughout Mexico. They're saying, let's start with putting panels on our production facilities, our warehouses.
We have the need and we have the real estate, literally, to put the panels on, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's where we're starting with them. There are other, you know, very compelling examples. We're working with Scotiabank, which, you know, your audience will be familiar with, Canadian mm-hmm. bank, but they've got substantial operations throughout LATAM, in Mexico in particular.
Okay.
So we've got a collaboration with Scotiabank Mexico. And this is brand new. I mean, in the last couple of months, Scotiabank Mexico has launched a green mortgage. So a green mortgage is substantively similar to a traditional home mortgage for a home, right? The difference is that there's a preferential rate. So a full 1% decrease on the rate that customers pay on their mortgages. In order for the mortgage to qualify as a green mortgage, the only way to do it currently is to install solar panels on your roof. Solfium is currently the only partner that is certified by Scotiabank Mexico to install these panels. So what this means for the consumer is that if you install solar on the home that is being mortgaged, you will pay a low interest rates. So your monthly payment with a solar system will be approximately equivalent to your mortgage without. Right, at the regular rate without the panels. So what this means is that there is effectively no incremental cost to installing the solar system. So this is the type of collaboration where we talk about, you know, win-win-win-win-win, you know, everybody wins, because, you know, we get a customer. Scotiabank in this case has a new finance origination, so they get this is a way for them to drive their lending business.
It's a differentiator for them as well, from a pure marketing message.
Yeah.
And so like in that, did they come to you, like, just curious of the mechanics, because also the big to small, you're a small organization based, you know, early days, working with large can often be a huge, because sometimes they just don't speak the same language, sure. Which obviously your background, your history makes sense while you were able to kind of translate, if you will, the big to small. But in that case, did they say, hey, we have a problem, like we have an opportunity, we're excited, we need to find a vendor? Just curious, like, how as a startup getting into that position, because that's like, those are gold relationships that often take a long time to farm out.
Sure, absolutely. I think, you know, let's be clear, it has been a challenge. It has been a heavy lift.
I appreciate your honesty, Zach. I appreciate your honesty.
I think, you know, we sometimes characterize the company as being young. You know, we talked about it. We're sort of 3 years old, but we're, you know, far from being inexperienced.
Yeah.
It originates from the founder group, and we've expanded from that, and we've been fortunate to be able to recruit, you know, some absolute top talent, you know, across the board, up and down the organization. But you know, I'll maybe talk specifically about Andres, who's been with Bombardier, you know, specifically involved in strategic corporate partnerships on the supply chain. Sorry, I didn't get back to the supply chain, but you know, Andres, you know, has negotiated contracts with multinational, you know, heavy industry manufacturing partnerships. When Andres was in Mexico, he was establishing an ecosystem for a wing assembly plant that involved some close collaboration with municipal, you know, state level and national governments. So we have, you know, we have strong commercial ties. Juan Osuna, same thing. I mean, he had commercial responsibility for Pretel's Latin American energy division. So he's got extensive commercial networks, industrial commercial networks throughout Mexico and beyond, in LATAM in particular. So, you know, this gave us, you know, the unfair advantage, if you will,
I love being a good unfair advantage. I'm glad you used that. I'm glad you used that term. But also the timing of these governments, these regulatory bodies, these organizations from municipalities going, this is on our radar, this is important to us. Oh, and you know how to talk our talk and speak our language. I can see how that, like, again, there's nothing more powerful than ideas aligning from a timing perspective as well.
Sure, absolutely.
And the skill to execute on it.
Sure. The execution is huge. The timing, you know, we sometimes get the question, you know, why now?
Yeah.
You know, solar is not new, right? This is solar 2.0 or solar 3.0, if you will. The sort of the ground that was broken by the early innovators in solar, has been critical, crucial to the evolution of the business.
This is the 30-year overnight success story, if you will.
That's right. Now, I talked about the unit economics having recently become compelling, absent government support, subsidies, et cetera, et cetera. Solar 1.0 relied on government support.
To make it viable.
So in Europe, they're far ahead in terms of penetration. Now, what happens often with these with these types of government incentives is you get some misalignments, right? We've seen it in some jurisdictions in Canada, overcapacity in the wrong places because the incentives were, there's unintended consequences of various incentives.
The art of extrapolating that graph far enough out to see what could happen.
Sure.
So sometimes we're not the best at that.
Yeah. So there's been some stumbles, there's been some ups and downs in the business early on. I think that now, though, we are very much, the time is now. The unit economics are going to drive adoption. I mean, I say that it's really driven by unit economics. We believe, we have strong conviction that solar panels will become ubiquitous, panels on every rooftop. And what we're doing is we're removing the friction. What this means is every time we engage with someone, people are becoming increasingly aware of these realities of the economics.
Well, you're able to start with them farther down the awareness chain versus having to do all that education 100%. Lift, which is 100%. From a sales perspective, go-to-market completely changes an 18-month sales cycle to a 6-month. I'm picking numbers out of the air a little bit, but every time you go in and they're like, okay, so tell me about solar. That takes a lot of time and a lot of educate and a lot of lift for a small company to do.
Mm. Yeah. I'll just mention another thing. I mean, you're down, the progress is uneven and, evolution is uneven and et cetera, et cetera. But, Mexico was not necessarily at the forefront of decarbonization efforts. But the state of Querétaro, which is where we're at, is the first state in Mexico to adopt a carbon tax. This is an example. So, and it came in January 2023. So it's been 1 year. And we're collaborating closely with them. And, this is another example of an openness, a willingness to engage with us. And, again, young company, but we've got, extensive expertise, experience, now increasingly proven ability to execute and to deliver value. The time is right. Let's put it that way.
Based on just the dynamics of Mexico and having so many large multinationals with manufacturing facilities or production plants or having boots on the ground there. Also, I'm assuming that really works the formula quite strong versus like you're not necessarily having to work with or need to go find the local big enough company because these multinationals who also have very strong net zero goals are on the ground in Mexico from a manufacturing perspective. Like if I just look at the formula, I can see where Mexico and you had experience and comfort in that jurisdiction. I could see where all the arrows started to point really quickly towards that part of the world. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Mexico is it's a large country. It's a developing country that has, huge potential. I mean, we talk about, macroeconomic global trends. I mean, nearshoring is real. So there are, we're at the start of a trend here. But there's a very substantial manufacturing base for North America under NAFTA that exists in Mexico, and that is growing. So you've got certainly the presence of multinationals. But it's also important, I mentioned earlier that there's, I referred to local installers. I mean, this is a feature of this market, is that there's high fragmentation in terms of executing the installation of these systems. So it is an important part of the value that we bring is a curation. So we select, we recruit the installers that are appropriate to execute the specific different types of jobs, right? A residential flat roof job in Mexico City is very different than an industrial project in Monterrey. So there's a great deal of fragmentation. So what we do is we recruit, We train, we certify these installers, so we are able to bridge a gap, let's say, between these multinationals that are operating locally and the sort of the local economy with the you know, the folks that are doing the installation on the ground.
Pardon my ignorance even in this question. Are you hiring a skilled workforce or are you creating a skilled workforce?
Yeah. Early on in the journey, we are hiring an existing skilled workforce. We have Solfium Academy, if you will. So our training and certification program is modular. So the training that we're doing currently is focused on the sales process, on the soft skills, if you will. So we're hiring installers that currently have the technical capabilities, and we are, you know, refining the sales process, refining the operations process, and leveraged with technology to help that installer run an efficient business and to adhere. I mean, our sales process is a big part of it, is how we provide peace of mind and comfort to the customer. So these local installers represent Solfium. So the engagement, everything to do with the engagement with the customer is an important element of our training program as it is today. As we grow, we expect to develop more of a bottom-up training. So where we will recruit, more junior partners and train them up also on the technical, the technical elements of doing the installation.
I appreciate that. Talk to me a little bit. What I love is I love a lot about what your story, but I really love is how clear it seems to me that you've articulated and understood as a business, as an operator, this is the thing, this is our promise, this is the problem, and now this is what we're going to do. Perfect example. We need to give comfort and security in the installation. So therefore, we need a university. Like the one begets the other. And oftentimes companies get caught up in, you know, what is our brand? Well, it's the problem you're solving and the promise and how you solve it. Talk to me a little bit about that journey, just the evolution from when you guys started out, like we're going to solve X. It's like, oh, well, if we're going to solve X, we better solve for W, Y, A, C, D and start like just hearing that evolution of identifying, because it's so easy to get distracted in the early days of growth. But what's our core competencies? What's our promise? And what do we need to deliver? Talk to me a little bit about just how that journey's evolved and probably evolving. I don't want to sound like it's done in any sense of the question.
For sure. For sure. We talk about this stuff. We try not to talk it about the philosophical stuff every day, but we do, you know.
Yeah. How do we deliver on the thing we promise to deliver better than anybody else?
Yeah, we do revisit this long-term visioning stuff often. And we talk about focus, right? I mean, what is it that we need to focus on? I mean, a startup has, you know, obviously limited resources initially. it's been an ongoing, you know, there's a lot of iteration, in this. The core conception of the model has remained pretty consistent, you know, of establishing this ecosystem, this marketplace. Now, the operational complexity, I mean, I think that, again, I go back to sort of the founding group and, you know, specifically Juan and Andres having been Juan in the solar business specifically, so a deep understanding of that business, and Andres being steeped in, the aerospace assembly process is you know the scrutiny that's involved and the rigor that is involved in that process,
the Q&A, that all the things that make that's mandatory for that space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the supply chain, including I don't know if I mentioned, but we use third party logistics to bring efficiencies to the supply chain. I mean, that's a conceptual process. I have a slide. It's got a box that talks about 3PLs, you know, a lot more complicated in the real world than that simple box. And, you know, how is it that we're able to operationalize that? A lot of it comes from, in this case, Andres has, you know, specific, you know, lived experience with these types of processes. So we understood, I think early on, both the conception of the model and the effort and that is required to bring it to life. We've been working on it. I mean, and we take shortcuts, if you will. This is what you have to do when you're building a startup. We have the conception of a center of excellence, but we didn't start from scratch training. We started working with the installers who are already, you know, the best in the business, if you will. And, you know, and that's why do we do that? Because, you know, and I haven't talked about this yet, but our flywheel of growth, you know, how this business will grow organically and exponentially is driven by customer satisfaction. Right.
We are, have to do a good job. You have to deliver.
You must do a good job. So we are conscious of unit economics to our business. We're proud of the fact that we're delivering positive margins right now. But we're not necessarily trying to maximize the margin today at the expense of a positive customer experience, because that satisfied customer will refer. I mean, we talk about, I haven't talked about this yet, but we are creating networks of networks where every one of our customer has a family, lives in a neighborhood, is part of, through our corporate context, they have business partners and they live. Yeah. So we're creating networks of networks. And how do those networks of networks grow? Through positive experiences that are driven by customer satisfaction. So it has been critical, you know, to work with partners that will ensure that positive customer experience.
At the end of the day, we still have to do what we said we were going to do and do it well.
Absolutely.
And so you can overcomplicate it. Talk to me about the, now moving into different markets, obviously the ties to the Mexican region, why the individuals, the partners. Let's just play with Canada for a minute. I love that you're based here. It's probably why you had through one degree of separation, you and I got introduced.
Sure.
Talk to me about what this type of a solution or your business model looks like if we just bring it to Canada. I know that, and that probably means, well, what part of Canada, Tyler? Because Quebec has a different relationship with electricity than Alberta has. Talk to me just a little bit, when you as a company start looking at your backyard, where does Canada fit into our readiness or just the opportunity from a market perspective for this solution?
Sure. So, you know, I mentioned that, you know, that solar, you know, the cost of solar is trending downwards. I think we're not by any means at the end of that journey. So as the economics improve, they improve everywhere. Now there are some, you know, there are some differences between different markets. You know, a couple things in Canada. I mean, well, no, first I'll say, you know, conceptually, the model that we're building is conceived, intended to be replicable
in
multiple jurisdictions. And conceptually, you know, a lot of these issues that exist in Mexico also exist in Canada. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, finding a reputable local installer is sort of analogous to trying to find a plumber or an electrician. If you move to a new city, you don't know anyone, how do you find someone to trust? So, you know, these things apply in Canada as well as they might in other jurisdictions. Now, you know, there are some unique characteristics to the place where we live. We have long summer days, short winter.
We're far away from the equator. Far away from the equator. Absolutely.
Short and cold winter days, which make the balancing. You know, there's balancing issues with the grid. You know, baseline power. I mean, anyone in Alberta is you know familiar with these with these issues. You know,
especially after the notice we had this winter that everybody turn your lights off.
Exactly. You know, these issues will get resolved. I'm very you know, there's technological innovation that is happening as we speak, that will continue to make that more and more favorable. I referenced earlier the relatively lower and more lower rates and relatively more stable networks. So, I mean, we haven't talked about resiliency, but another reason to make the conversion with storage is resiliency. So, you know, traditionally in Canada, we have not had, you know, large issues with brownouts and blackouts.
Yeah.
So, you know, the stability of the system, the relatively low cost and efficient system in the electricity markets in Canada, are, you know, make the business case less enticing. I mean, you also referenced the fact that, unfortunately, from a business perspective, Canada is a small market and we have 10 jurisdictions that each have their own regulatory, their regulatory framework. So, you know, it makes some very, very small markets, if you will. So from a global business perspective, it's challenging to tackle Canada as an operating market. So, you know, we rank markets. I mean, I talked about the Venn diagrams. We have, obviously, we have a presence in Canada. So that, so that's like sort of a plus. There's some other elements that, that are, you know, less compelling. So, I mean, you know, we don't rule out operating in Canada. Conceptually, it can work. You know, eventually, we haven't talked about the sort of the long-term vision for Solfium, but this eventually, once we demonstrate the model, once we scale it throughout Mexico, the next step is to replicate in other markets.
Yeah.
And that can take a number of different forms. We haven't talked about the manner of entry into new markets, but it could take the form of a licensing agreement for the software, the technology that enables our ecosystem.
Your secret sauce of how we make it work. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it could be that we're going to enter new markets through either SaaS licensing, strictly just the software ecosystem, or License Plus, which would include the manufacturing relationships, our training operating manuals, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that could be a way that we accelerate entry into new markets. Who knows?
Interesting. When you look at the U.S., who knows? Well, I sense a future episode, but we'll park that for now. When you look at other markets, obviously the U.S., still state by state, but each, like, there's some states that are literally the size of Canada. That's obvious, you know. Yep. California, that uniformity in the regulatory framework of like, okay, we can go in and there's enough size and potential here with one consistent, slightly movable, but set of rules. Obviously that feels like a huge weighting in the Venn diagram that can make a go, no go answer really quickly for the business.
Sure. Sure. And, you know, listen, regulation is complex, and, you know, electricity markets are, regulation is inherent. I mean, this is an important piece of infrastructure for everyone involved.
It's an essential. So, yes, absolutely.
It's an essential. Yeah,
If you don't think it is, just go pull your fuse panel and watch what happens to all the activity at your home. It grinds to a halt.
Yeah. So it's inevitable that there will be regulation, you know, and we're not sort of scared of regulation. Regulation, of course, you know, there's all core. It's a hairy issue because there inevitably their politics become involved. Then there's bureaucracy and implementation. It's challenging.
Yeah.
But you know, the one thing is you try to deal with. Well, every business person will tell you if we can get certainty. Clarity, you know, long-term perspective
on de-risking
and just understanding the framework that we'll be working under. You know, that's what we're seeking. And you know, regulation isn't a negative, just, you know, inherently. I mean, in fact, it can increase the credibility of an entire industry, right? The absence of any regulation, it can, and it is, a race to the bottom. And then you get dissatisfied customers because there's no bar that to get over, and you get subpar components, you get subpar quality in the installation,
and can so destroy it can destroy the whole industry before it even gets out of the gate, right?
That's right. Don't want to do it more than, you know, you don't want to adapt more than
There's definitely a right amount. hey, curious question. And this is me reading a lot of, I've just finished the whole series on the cartels in Mexico, which was quite entertaining. I'm not going to ask you a cartel question specifically, but how is dealing in another jurisdiction where potentially corruption, potentially it's got a different regulatory and there's different ways of doing business than maybe we expect as the norm in North America? I'm asking it very broadly because I'm not trying to stereotype or point any kind of story, but I know people have done business in Mexico and they're like, it's different, Tyler. Don't underestimate that. It's very different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, 100%. It's different in Mexico. I mean, every jurisdiction is different. I've done business in, I mean, I don't know how many, but jurisdictions globally, worldwide. And, you know, one common trait is that, you know, I talked about regulation, but there's also taxation. You know,
yes.
Every government everywhere does some form of regulation and some form of taxation. And they're usually trying to, you know, they're trying to raise money for government services. So that happens everywhere. It's different. Everywhere
and how it gets executed, but it's still taxation. I understand what you're saying.
So, and you know, in my experience working globally in various jurisdictions, it's about local partners. I mean, there is no way that I can go there and fully understand in a reasonable period of time how to navigate
the nuance
the nuance of the local environment. So it's always about local partners. That's why, you know, that's why we're in Mexico. because of Juan and Andres's ties there. We are absolutely bringing in people that can augment the depth of our experience and our ties. So that includes our advisory board. We have experts in the industry in Mexico who can inform us and can ensure that we are aware of the relevant issues. Also investors. I mean, it's been important that we get investors who have an understanding of the local market. Redwood Ventures is one case in point. Venture capital firm based in Guadalajara has existing knowledge of the market dynamics. So there's an element of validation by having them on board. And of course, they also have networks, which is valuable both from a commercial perspective. They're able to connect us with commercial opportunities through their networks of limited partners that invest in their funds. So that's another example of how critical it is to build local ties. I mean, there's just no way that you can parachute into a new jurisdiction and expect to have success.
Literally anywhere. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I appreciate that. I'm curious, what's been your experience? Like, in contrast, what is the VC ecosystem? What is the new business? Like, what's that scene, quote unquote, ecosystem, more proper word, but what's the scene like in Mexico? Is there a strong, community behind startups? And just, I know nothing about that community from that perspective.
Sure. It's an emerging industry, emerging market, emerging industry in an emerging market.
Okay. Yeah.
There was a surge of interest and activity sort of immediately prior to COVID. It kind of got slowed down there. And of course, no one is immune to the interest rate, environment and pressures over the last, couple of years. So there's been a cooling off, I would say, from big macro perspective, and there's been a cooling off globally. So all of these global forces, Latin America and Mexico are not immune to these global forces. The ecosystem is still active and growing. I mean, there are green shoots. There are increasingly some success stories coming out of Latin America.
Okay.
So the market has matured significantly, and is gaining attention globally. Increasingly, and if there's a negative tendency around sort of interest rates, one counter force is that if there are a few industries that are still attracting capital, and climate is certainly one of them.
Yeah.
So there's some headwinds globally. I think Latin America, I don't think, is disproportionately impacted by the negative global headlines. Impacted for sure. But it's still a huge market.
There's still things going on.
Absolutely.
And for you, having the, being based here, but having the bulk of your operations there, when you were looking from an investment perspective, sounds like your investment partners were from the jurisdiction where you were getting this thing off the ground.
It's a mix. We have from the start have had the intention of building a global company. Mm-hmm. Headquartered in Canada. I mean, we haven't talked too much about the Nexus in Canada, but the intention has always been to build a global company. So the way that we've structured the company, the parent company is a Canadian company that owns the IP, the trademark. The expertise will be eventually licensed in a number of different jurisdictions, so allowing for global expansion.
But there's an operating entity set up in the jurisdiction,
where
you specifically mentioned in Mexico.
That's right.
All ladders back up to the Canadian entity.
Exactly. Okay. So we've always had that perspective. And, our investor, the cap table, reflects that. We have we have professional investors from Canada. We have Propiedad Capital is an impact investor. Rallycap is a Silicon Valley-based early stage fund that was initially set up to invest in emerging market fintech. which is, you know, very well aligned with our intent and to eliminate friction from a financing perspective for our customers. But they're based in Silicon Valley, so we've got access to that sort of, or it's opening a door into that ecosystem.
Well, I really appreciate the relationships each one of those comes with, which you mentioned earlier.
Sure. And then there's Savia Ventures, which is a Latin American climate focused fund. Also some investors in the US, LPs in that fund. And then finally Catapult VC, which is a Norwegian Oslo based fund, which provides us with some ties to Europe. I mean, we've got some ties to Europe through the Pretel Group in Germany. Juan in Spain, so we do a lot of our tech development in Spain as well. You know, I mentioned earlier that Europe is quite advanced in climate tech generally. So there's a lot of expertise that we can gain from exposure to that ecosystem. So we're very much building a global story. Going forward, we expect that to also be the case. So a mix of international investors and some folks who have a deep understanding of the markets that we're working in.
It makes so much sense when you lay it all out. And just like what you said earlier, with every one of those relationships, they have networks, they have doors that can be opened. And like, oh, do you know who you need to talk to? Let me do an intro. And you just save 4 months of looking, chasing, calling, waiting in someone's lobby to talk to them. And just looking at the European market, very obvious how far ahead they are from these types of technologies. Back to your, you know, Venn diagram, was that driven, again, regulatory favorable and costs high? Because always thinking about the cost of energy in Europe being more than here, just thinking back, you know, because it's always, let's look to somewhere who's been where we are 10 years ago and how did they deal with it? Was that driven primarily by cost and also a positive regulatory framework for making solar and just making different choices around energy creation and consumption?
Yeah, I mean, my level of expertise in the European market is limited, but I'll just make a couple comments. I mean, I think that certainly the regulatory environment is tighter, if you will, in Europe. Okay. So there's been a drive that's been driven by regulation. Excuse me. There's also been more government support to accelerate the transition, right? So there have been greater levels of subsidies, and various types of incentives to so a combination of support and regulatory imperatives have driven the development of the ecosystem quicker. So penetration rates are higher. Which has driven, you know, it has allowed the technology, the ecosystem, the maturity of the industry to be further advanced in Europe than it is, frankly, anywhere else in the world.
Anywhere in the world.
I mean, yeah, I'm just curious. The U.S., of course, is absolutely catching up with the IRA.
Once they decide to do something, it tends to go very quickly, right? 100%. Interesting, Zach. So many questions and so much to unpack around where it's going, and really enjoy the perspective around, you know, being in the market that you're in, you know, what it required and why you chose it, and just looking at everything from a strategic perspective of really truly stepping back and looking at the world as a global, like, this is an offering that we have. Where's the best place to go? Where's our strengths? Just thinking from that startup perspective of really taking a solid inventory of what your value and your core competencies are, and then applying that in the right way versus maybe just doing the thing that happens to be right in front of you. Might not be the right thing.
Sure.
A lot of discipline in that. Have you, obviously, I appreciate, you know, mentors, coaches, advisory. You mentioned advisory board. How critical has that been for? Because it sounds like you all, as the founders, have incredibly deep bench and experience. And at the same time, we all have blind spots. Touch on just a little bit of, like, you know, for all the startup founders that are listening, you know, sometimes those blind spots can be even bigger when you have a lot of experience. Because you, like, I know,
sure.
But that how the advisory board, and how did that play a part for you in the getting to where you are today?
Yeah. Absolutely critical. To your point, I mean, we have experience, but it is, you know, three people's experience. So okay. It's not, you know, I've, you know, I often say I used to work with emerging enterprises, which, you know, that's not necessarily the same thing as a startup, which it is a different mindset. You know, our exposure to that mindset and to really, you know, have massive ambition and to do things at 10 times the speed than you normally, you know, would have in a prior life. You know, we've definitely needed to surround ourselves, you know, with folks that have been there, done that. And on our advisory board, I mean, I think of Dan Park is a perfect example of that. Dan Park, CEO of Clutch, now the used car marketplace. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you may.
I have heard of it. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So Dan Park is CEO of Clutch, a former GM of Uber Canada, launched Uber Eats. That Uber Eats was launched in Toronto. That was a global pilot. And Dan was in charge of that project. So you know he's certainly steeped in that world and has been a specific source of expertise in that respect.
Guidance and perspective.
We've got Kent Richardson is a lawyer in Silicon Valley as well. Hugely valuable from an IP perspective. I mean, he lives in the Valley. He has a network is invaluable. We've also joined various accelerators, you know, to immerse ourselves into that startup specific ecosystem, to navigate between, you know, starting out with a PowerPoint and, you know, changing the world, which is not an understatement of what we're hoping to do.
But surrounding yourself with those people and I'm assuming those were all relationships that came through some funding partners, some participating in these accelerators, like getting those people to sit around your table. That's no easy task. So which comes back to the relationships and building that network.
Sure. Absolutely.
To make the difference, to tell you when you're about to step on a landmine or to just avoid that whole area altogether and go this way. Zach, if I'm in Canada and I wanted to work with you, I would not be able to as of yet. Am I limiting that to make that statement?
Well, you know, I mean, you know, it's a very dynamic.
Spoken like a true. Now the entrepreneur Zach comes in. Well, Tyler, let's not say that. Give us a call. Yeah. We'll talk.
Sure. I think when we talking about the activity that's happening in Canada, I mean, this is a global company. You know, this is the new reality of global commerce, if you will. So there are, you know, our headquarters are, it's somewhat virtual, but our headquarters is in Canada. I sit in Calgary. We have, you know, various collaborators, consultants, contractors that are located throughout the country in Montreal, in Toronto, in Calgary, that we are working with on various, you know, elements of the business. So, but I see the future for Solfium as being, you know, in Canada as being the headquarters where, you know, a lot of good jobs are, where we're building, you know, building the global branding strategy, the strategy around product development and how that's going to evolve, all of the corporate supports functions, the center of excellence, you know, the training modules, where's that all going to come from? I mean, none of this is definitive. But all of these activities that are associated with growing an international business, you know, those are things that can happen in Canada. They, you know, some of it's going to happen, like I said, in Spain. Some of it's going to happen in Mexico. Some of it, some of it's going to happen elsewhere. And that's just the reality of global business. But I'm here. I would love for us to be able to generate, you know, benefits to our customers and economic activity in lots of different places, Canada included.
I appreciate that. That's an excellent answer. And Zach's maybe going to go into politics later on after he finishes at Solfium. Zach, thanks for coming on. Obviously, solfium.com website. You guys get a lot of cool information. It's well laid out, easy to navigate. If someone wants to reach out and chat with you, LinkedIn, do you have a preferred form? There's a million ways. Do you have a preferred?
Sure. I mean, I think LinkedIn is probably a good one. I think you can find me on LinkedIn, Zach Magnin, Z-A-C-H. That's probably the best way to get home.
There's so many ways, but we all have our preferred. So that's why I like to at least put it out there in that way. Zach, thanks for coming on today. Thanks for your time. Love what you guys are doing. And I do. Yes, I do have a place in my heart. I love that you're global, but headquartered in Calgary. That does resonate for me for sure. I think and the more we tell those stories, because there's a lot of cool companies doing cool stuff here that they're doing somewhere else, but they're based here. And I think those stories are just as important to tell.
Of course.
Thank you,
well,
sir.
Thanks a lot for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure as well. Thank you.